Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. Happy 4th of July. This special quick update edition is being brought to you from Peculiar, Missouri. If you hear loud booms in the background, that is just fireworks. I am broadcasting from the road, and I just wanted to check in and say hello to everybody and happy 4th of July, and give just a quick update. I want to remind people that I went to the Glore Psychiatric Museum yesterday, July 3rd, and I will be going back again on July 5th. I had a great time looking around the museum and learning about some of the new exhibits that they have, particularly on how these things are interpreted artistically by people in a exhibit called Gray Matters, which I think thought was really interesting and gave a lot of insight into and shows, has actual old restraint cuffs and different types of restraints that are used or and were used in the 19th century and beyond. And so it was a really interesting trip, and I'm looking forward to trying to put forward an idea about an exhibit in one of the rooms that routinely switches its exhibit space. And it would include things that we found through the devoiced process, which I'm really excited about, including an 8 to 10 minute long video that would be made specifically for the Glore Psychiatric Museum. As well as other kinds of memorabilia and visual interpretations that would be good in a museum. So one of the things I was talking about with the executive director there, Sarah Wilson, was the idea of both how a person is turned into a mental patient, but then also what this liberation movement is about and what this civil rights movement is about. And so tomorrow, one of the things I'm going to be doing is checking out in the Black Archives at the St. Joseph Museum, there is also an exhibit on the civil rights movement. And so I'm going to check that out to see how they frame that. But if you are listening and know or have some ideas about how to visually represent our movement, I'd be really interested in hearing what your thoughts are. Today, like I said, I'm just kind of checking in and seeing if anybody has anything specific that they want to talk about or if they were just calling in. I want to thank people who have contacted me asking if I was okay, and because the shows have been really short or not on at all for the last couple of nights while I'm on the road. And so, yes, I am okay, and I thank you for listening and for checking in with me. If people do have tips that they'd like to leave for me, they can do that on the tip line at area code 718-273-8708, 273-8708. And when I get back to New York, I will get those messages. And for any of you who don't know, in classic Lauren style, I dropped my phone and broke it right before I left for the trip. So if you've been trying to get in touch with me by my phone, my phone's broken. So anyway, that's where that's at. Anyway, I just wanted to check in real quick and say hi and let people know that I was out here. And if you have ideas about visual representations of our movement to be displayed in a museum, let me know, because I'm trying to put together an entire treatment to present to see whether or not that would meet what the Glore Psychiatric Museum's expectations for an exhibit are. But there is definite interest, and we're in definite conversations about it. And so tomorrow night, on Saturday, July 5th, we will have an entire 2-hour show, and that will run from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. And I want to remind people about July 11th and 12th at the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance and its headquarters in Utica, New York, for an organizing meeting. If you'd like to join, you can call the Alliance at area code 800-654-7227. And then July 13th, beginning at 6 p.m. through July 16th at 6 p.m., we will be on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health for the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day demonstration and vigil. And the vigil will be held in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health from July 13th through the 16th. And again, the Alliance's number, if you'd like to get involved with this or any of the Alliance's activities, area code 800-654-2227. And then Mind Freedom International's Creative Revolution Conference will be July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut at Wisdom House. And that's going to be a great time. Robert Whitaker and Mary Ellen Copeland are keynote speakers. And then there's going to be activities from Hearing Voices Network, Coming Off of Psychiatric Drugs, Soteria House, Pure Respite, and open dialogue. And so it should be a jam-packed few days in Connecticut, July 24th through 27th. And you can find out more information from Mind Freedom International at mindfreedom.org. And then July 28th to the 31st, I believe, is Youth Power University in Albany, New York at St. Rose College, where there will be two choices of classes that students can pick for this semester, a mini semester, either peer advocacy or systems advocacy. And students will have the opportunity to sleep in the dorms at St. Rose College and eat meals on campus. And Youth Power in New York State is the way you get to find them. And so I think that there's a lot of really exciting things going on. I want to call you, and I want to thank you for listening. And, I think that we must continue to move forward and organize however we can, wherever we can. And I just want to say that I really hope you all have a great night out there, and call in tomorrow night on open lines from 9 to 11 p.m. And I look forward to giving you further updates about what happens at the Gore Psychiatric Museum tomorrow. And learning from you what's going on. I'm just seeing that there is a caller from area code 845. I'm just going to open your line if you'd like to talk, because I was, going to make it a little loud. If you'd like to talk and say something, because I was just going to cut the show short tonight unless anybody was online. But if you're there and you'd like to say something, 845, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. It's Anthony from Rockland. How are you?
Hey, Anthony. I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. I wanted to wish you and everybody out there a happy 4th of July. I know you said you were going to cut the show short tonight. I just actually just called and just started tuning in right now. But I just wanted to give a quick update on my AOT status.
Yeah, and believe me, I can stay on till 11 o'clock, so I'm in no rush to go. I just didn't know whether or not people were going to be, because I just scheduled it this minute, and so, yeah, please, if you'd like to give an update about that, that would be great, and I'm sure people would really like to hear.
Okay, sure. I had my AOT hearing on last Monday, and basically it was good news and kind of okay news. The good news was it was up for renewal for a full year, and the judge denied it for a year. but he knocked it down to 6 months, which is the kind of okay news. But the other piece of good news is that I'm going to have a rehearing in 2 to 3 weeks for my AOT status.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that is great news that you will have a rehearing, and very hopeful that they weren't willing to extend it for a full year, huh? I mean, but still, there's a fight that is going to be had, right?
Yes.
Legally,
It's not over. I mean, I don't know. When I spoke with a lawyer, she said that my question was, if there was going to be a rehearing, would there be a possibility of them renewing it for a full year anyway, if I were to lose that rehearing? And she said that she said it wasn't likely, but I got to get a more clear answer on that, because I don't want to have to go to a rehearing, and then after having it knocked down to 6 months, then a new judge, there's going to be a new judge. The new judge would enable it for a full year after the previous judge had it knocked down to 6 months. I was trying to be counterintuitive, you know. But
I would get that in writing and notarized.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really hoping that we can fight it, and I could get off AOT, and I could just go about my life and live a normal, happy, fulfilling life without having to have any, well, at least in the very long term, any more psychiatric involvement. But after I get off AOT, I'm gonna have to deal with the psychiatry for a while. I mean, I'm mandated to take medication once a month by injection, and once the AOT expires, I won't be doing that anymore. But I still will be taking medication orally until I could safely wean myself off, which would be a long time. It would be about 2 years, I'm thinking.
Unfortunately, like, the fact that it's a drug and that there's an actual withdrawal process that people have to go through, and to do that in a smart way that doesn't set you up is, you know, but I think that even that you have to have these kinds of conversations on any level is just such a violation. And I've been saying on the show, I don't know how people hold it together, and I don't know how you hold it together when there are people who are like a judge and a prosecutor trying to prove that you're quote-unquote mentally ill, and that the reason that you need this is because you have a mental illness, and there's no evidence of a mental illness existing. So how one is supposed to hold it together when you're under that kind of fear of the amount of control that these people have over your lives is just for any, you know, for you, Anthony, going through it, and for anybody going through it, I don't possess this skill. And so it's a really scary prospect to know that that's what you could potentially be, what people are up against if they're involved in any of this.
Yeah, and there are millions of people all over, not just this country, but worldwide, that have to deal with poor psychiatry, or psychiatry on some level, one form or another. But there are many, many people that are in my position, and many people that are like a lot worse off, that they just have like no, they have no bearing at all, whether they have no bearing on at all, whether they're going to live their lives free of an oppressive system, you know.
Right. And how do you?
Excuse me.
Well, that's the thing that gets people to hold it together. That you know that if you don't do this, that they're then going to have the right to really eliminate any freedom that you have, and that level of oppression causes one to be able to control themselves of what it is they potentially could face. For as bad as this is, it can only get worse if I don't do what they want me to do. That's not treatment. That's not trust. That's not anything that a good, sound relationship is built on.
It's as if, and a lot of times when I was an inpatient, unfortunately, in the past, they would use quote-unquote treatment almost as if it was like a punishment. So say, for instance, if you had a patient that was upset about something and maybe they had an argument with one of the workers or another patient or whatever, the doctor or the nurse or whoever would come over and say, so-and-so, if you're not going to cooperate and if you're not going to calm down, we're gonna give you an injection. It was like, are you treating the person for an issue they're having, or are you going to use it as punishment? It's like, it completely illegitimizes the whole entire field of psychiatry. It's like, you're supposed to be helping people and you're supposed to be treating people, but then you're gonna because I myself was once threatened with an injection in a patient because I had a disagreement with the doctor and I started raising my voice a little bit, which I shouldn't have, but I was upset. And they came over to me. It's like, Anthony, if you don't cut it out and calm down, we're gonna give you an injection. And it's like, okay, so am I being treated? Is it a treatment or is it a punishment? And it's like the same thing with involuntary outpatient commitment. It's like a punishment. It's not like treatment. It's like a punishment. And it's like they're punishing you for disobeying them and being disobedient. And the morning of my court hearing last Monday, I was actually supposed to have went in for my monthly injection on the Friday before, but my nephew was graduating from upper elementary school, and they had a whole big ceremony at school, and then we had a whole entire celebration afterwards. I wanted to be with my family. I wanted to be with my nephew. That's more important to me. So I told them I had to reschedule for the next week. I told them I was really busy. I had family affairs I had to attend to. They're like, no, you have to come in for your injection today. I was like, no, I'll be in there next week. I was like, and then the weekend went by, and then on Monday at 9:00 in the morning, I got a phone call from the nurse there at the hospital saying, Anthony, you need to come in for your injection tonight. And I was busy that morning too because I had the court hearing in the morning. I had errands I had to do during the morning. So I called back and I was like, listen, can we just reschedule till tomorrow? It's just one more day and I'll be in there definitely. I have a pristine record of being compliant. I've always been to my appointments. They said, Anthony, no, you have to come today or we're going to have a pickup order issued for you and the police are going to come and pick you up and bring you to inpatient. So I had to go and drop everything, go get my injection, and come back and rush around and get ready for the court hearing in the afternoon. Ridiculous, you know?
Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. I want to say, line 202, your line is open.
Such hello, Lauren. Right, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. I don't know whether you can hear me too well. I'm in a very... where I am at home, there's a lot of fireworks going on, so I don't know if you're going to be able to hear me okay because the fireworks even have come into the walls of my home, so I don't know if you can hear me or not. But I was listening to the guy talking about his need to connect with his family, and just Thursday I had talked to someone at the hospital, at a state hospital, who I hadn't seen physically in many months. And the young lady told me that she can't come to the other meetings that they have for us people coming in because she eloped. That's the word that they use. She left and she had to go, her mother was sick, and she went to see her mother. In other words, when she had privileges to go outside, she left the hospital. And therefore, she has no communication with anybody, mostly just family members that visit, and she can't go outside for privileges or anything like that. And I people don't understand that there are some people that have been in psychiatric hospitals that they don't get a chance to go home, they don't get a chance to visit, they don't get a chance to go to funerals or loved ones. And even with assisted outpatient treatment, people will find that their life is very much restricted. And when he said he had to spend time with his nephew, I can very much understand that. People don't understand that your whole life can be adjudicated. The things that you're doing with your family may be cut off because of commitment. Outpatient commitment can do that as well.
Right, and I think that that's part of the problem is that people don't realize that these are the ways in which your humanity is stolen from people. And I don't know, Anthony, I have such a respect for you that you're doing this as so civilly as you are. I and for anybody else doing that, I mean, the way that people's just lives are stolen from them in this process is really horrifying.
It's really
like people have to really just give up everything. They have to submit. In other words, he wanted to have a change of his court date. That was, for them, unreasonable. In other words, everything has to be catered to the system, and your needs are never taken into account.
Right. Anthony, what were you trying to say? Sorry.
I was just going to say my only word of advice as somebody that's been through the process and who's actually going through the process right now, to anybody out there that's listening that's facing the same thing, just try to be as patient as possible. That's the key, is patience. You just got to be as patient as possible, and you got to try to see the light at the end of the tunnel because they can't. I mean, the one lawyer when I was speaking to her said that if you comply with if you consent to everything that they say, that they'll try to keep you on AOT forever. You just got to kind of be patient, but you also got to kind of fight it. You can't really consent to it, because if you consent to it, they're probably going to want to keep you on AOT forever. So you just got to be patient, and you just got to be as compliant as possible. As much as I know a lot of people may not, and myself included, I would rather not have to deal with, but it's the only way. You have to kind of convince them that you're seeing it their way, and you have to be as patient and compliant as possible. And there's a way out. I mean, I have a rehearing in like 2 to 3 weeks. That may be my key. That may be my exit to AOT, and I'll be able to live. I mean, I'm seeing a private therapist right now. I'm going above and beyond what they're asking me from me in the AOT order, and that's part of what we're trying to tell them is I'm taking care of myself, I'm living healthy, I'm getting help on my own, and I'm going to continue to do that. So just try to be patient, anybody out there, and try to be as compliant as possible, and there'll be an end to it, hopefully. That's all I can say. That's the only advice I can offer.
I don't know if I didn't hear that. How did this come about?
You mean my court date?
How did it come about?
Oh, well, why I was on AOT? Well, because I was non-compliant with medication in the past, and I was hospitalized a number of times.
What brought it to their attention that you were non-compliant? You weren't in agreement with the treatment they had selected for you.
At first I wasn't happy about it, and I told them I wasn't happy about it, but now I told them that I agree with everything that they say, and they're still extending the AOT order. Even if you're compliant, they'll try to extend it.
What I'm asking is that did your wife or some other loved one bring it to their attention, or just the doctors that they on their own they decided to pull you in?
Yeah, no, it was just the doctors. It was just the mental health staff and the psychiatrist and the clinician.
And I think that this is part of the problem is that. I mean, not only can it be like your family or your roommate or the county commissioner or anybody, but also the person that you're supposed to be having this trusting relationship with can be the person who, you know, gets you, to have to comply with this. And how are you supposed to have any kind of trusting relationship with somebody who is testifying against you to mandate you to have to continue to see them? I mean, this is like... This is napping. This is off. And it's so, I don't think that until somebody really literally sits in court and watches this process and sees what this is, it's funny because every time I go to court, I wind up having this very traumatized response to it of where I've actually had to call people in my support network saying, like, I am going to Like, I don't know how I didn't get arrested today just watching this. Like,
well,
you know what I mean?
For
what I wanted to do to what it was that you could do. This is that there is the idea that there is no defense for people, that there is no way to challenge this without those who are challenging it having their position jeopardized.
I think a lot of people have the myth that a person is going to be adjudicated because they did something wrong and while they were not in agreement with their treatment. And it doesn't have to be that. It could just be that you're just in disagreement. So my point in asking that question is that a lot of people have the myth that, you know, when people are pulled in for outpatient treatment, it's because, well, it's because they committed a crime during the time or they attacked somebody or something, and it does not have to be that way. In fact, in most of the cases, it is not. A person hasn't done anything except for maybe be out of agreement with lifestyle or social order for them to come under AOT. So anybody literally could be mandated to go to therapy, mandated to take chemicals, mandated to go this place or that place. I hope you're not hearing the fireworks.
Yeah, we are hearing them, but I should also let people know that I'm literally sitting in a field of fireworks in Missouri, and so it's on this end too.
If you have to cut me out, I understand. I'm just in a very patriotic part of town, and you know, a lot of our peers are locked up at not too far from where I live, and they don't have the freedom. This is supposed to be the 4th of July to celebrate the anniversary of our country. But many people, they don't enjoy these freedoms that we have.
Well, that's one of the reasons I felt it necessary to do the show tonight, even though I'm sitting in a really loud place. Because I do have the freedom to do this and to speak, and for those people who are out there, and for our brothers and sisters who are locked up right now, or who are afraid of being locked up, or who have lost their lives to this, that we absolutely need to be able to speak out and remember that not everybody in America is free, and that anybody and that everybody is at risk for this, and at any given point in time. If people misinterpret it the way it is that you're quote-unquote behaving and suggest that, you know, what your problem is, and then all of a sudden you have this monster response from the system that is just waiting to respond to somebody. You know, it's like their job is to respond, and so they're anxious and eager to respond. And you know, that not all of us get out alive, and some of us, when we have these interactions, wind up dead. And so no matter what happens, to cause somebody to get to this point of where they're having to come in every 3 or 6 months to defend themselves to court, you know, that's part of what's prompting this. That just that the fact that a court order can be 3 or 6 months, that every 3 or 6 months your life is disrupted by this thing further in anticipation as to whether or not you're going to be free after this is over. And in some ways, I think it may be like when people are waiting every 3 to 6 months to find out whether or not their cancer has returned, or whether or not the cancer has, you know, gotten to a point of where they need to have some kind of. And so what those blood tests are like and all those other tests and waiting. And so how much of a business is this, and how much of a necessity is this for this kind of, it's another whole kind of torture, legal torture. I imagine. Anyway, I get very emotional about this, and I'm Yvonne, I want to thank you for pointing that out about the fact that it is the 4th of July, and that there are people who who can't just make a phone call or reach out or go and do what they want to do tonight. And
yeah, the young lady that that I was talking about, her name is Juliet, and she's in her 20s, and she's been there for about 7 years, and she is not even allowed to use the computer. To hear your show, there are people that that they have phone privileges, people have computer privileges, and you'd be surprised that even though people are very restricted, like they know about mind freedom and other people, because there are people like me that come in to give them the information.
And I think that that's so important, and for people who are working in these roles, to have this as part of one's role of being able to pass that kind of information along.
Transitions don't do that, because part of their job is to make sure that people are in agreement with the system and that they are able to see that because they are sick.
Right. But I think that that's the problem. But the original idea of support definitely included this idea of passing along this information, which now the general peer worker isn't allowed to do. So that's I think that remains part of the problem. I'm sorry if these I don't know if these fireworks are translating over behind you on my end, but it's nice to be around some patriotism.
I've gone to another part of the house, so I can hopefully it'll be quieter.
Yeah. I think Anthony, I don't know if you're still there, but
I'm still here.
You know, I just appreciate the advice that you want to be giving to people, and you know how you some insight into how you've done this and what you've been through, and for sharing this, because I think it's really important for people to know about, and for people who are going through it themselves to be able to hear that they're not alone in this, and that, you know, that there's support.
What is your support date, Anthony?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. I heard fireworks. Can you repeat the question, please?
What is your court date?
Oh, my new court date is, I don't have a specific date just yet, but it's going to be 2 to 3 weeks. So probably either the week of the 13th or the week of the 21st.
And what state are you in?
I'm in New York.
Oh, okay. Is there anything else that the public can do to help you?
No, not right now. I mean, I just got to go and go to the court. It's basically going to be the same rehashing of the last court date. It's just going to be a different judge, and depending on how he or she views the case, they're going to make their determination based on the evidence that was in the last court date. So it's going to be basically the same thing, except a different judge. But no, there's nothing else anybody else can do for me. I basically have to kind of hope it goes my way. But, I know there's many, many, many other people out there going through similar situations. Some are even worse. So I just give them my support. And just like I said before, my only word of advice is patience. You just got to be really patient, because there are people that have been on AOT. I heard stories like there's this one guy that was on AOT for 5 to 6 years. And that my old psychiatrist told me he was on AOT for like 5 years. But because Kendra's Law has only been in effect in New York since 1999, so there have probably been people on it longer, since 99. But you just got to be patient.
It's such a violation. This law has got to be changed.
Indenture.
This law is taxing. I mean, and every time you turn around, they just are adding more and more to it. Like, you know, like for anybody who doesn't hasn't been following like the legislative pattern of this, you know, just most recently at the end of last session, it was passed by the Senate and forwarded to the Assembly Mental Hygiene Committee, where they, you know, eliminate the sunset date, which was supposed to be 2017. Where the law would end, and added, extended the time that they can go back that would apply, that would cause one to fit the criteria for it. So what they've done is it used to be 48 months that you were in danger to self or others. Now it's 48 months plus however long you were incarcerated or institutionalized, and they've made it so that the law applies to everybody who's incarcerated. And institutionalized, and who just people who may not comply with psychiatry. So it's very, on a legislative angle, Anthony, I would love for you to come back on a night when we could really talk about on a strategic level of changing this law, getting this law off the books once and for all, and really a full-on campaign to the Assembly. And to put a face on this, because I don't think that they ever understand that it's not just a 6 month period. It could be a 6 month period that continually goes on for, you know, 4, 5, 10, who knows how long, how many years. And I think that this is one of the points that nobody really ever talks about is how long, because they always just say, well, it's a 6 month period, and so people go, well, 6 months, that's not that bad. That's not long. You know what I mean? But they don't realize. And then those judges and prosecutors and defenders and bailiffs and stenographers and court officers, they all have to be paid, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is another whole industry. That was, what, like 7 or 8 people? You know what I mean? For, you know, those people are all getting paid to do this. And so that's like another whole monstrous chunk of money that the states are paying for this and, that people need to be aware of, I think.
And you want to have frequent reviews, because up until 10 years ago, we had open-ended outpatient commitment in the District of Columbia. And only as a result of different lawsuits did they really, you know, change the law. In other words, and I think that it was like this because you would have people who would come here to protest, like we call the White House cases. Like if you jump the fence at the White House or were protesting at the Capitol, it's possible that you could go to a state hospital. At that time, you'd go to our state hospital, and you would just be there forever. And if they released the person, they would be on outpatient commitment. But very few people were released. I think the last person who did not go to the state hospital who was like that was a guy who shot 2 police officers, but that 2 officers at the Capitol. But there's a myth that somehow people that are put on outpatient treatment is because they're dangerous to the community. It doesn't have anything to do with public safety at all. It's just that you just have to have a psychiatrist, a healthcare professional that speaks on behalf of the community that says that you need this treatment. No danger or anything is involved.
Right, and I think that's really important to hit home. But I want to say, even if there was some, you know, perceived sense of danger or something at some point in time, that to be able to say that psychiatry has an answer for that is ludicrous, and it is fraud. And so I think that it's got to be both sides, because the argument that we were using for so long, and I am so guilty of this, and I am so sorry, that we're not dangerous or anything like that, has now just created an extension of the law over to anybody who's ever been incarcerated. And so even though it's true that we're generally not dangerous, and that if that dangerousness even exists, it's more often toward ourselves than toward other people, and that all of that is very, very, very subjective, and laws differ wide varyingly throughout different parts of this country as to what's legal and illegal to begin with. So understanding all of that, but psychiatry does not have the answers for this. If somebody is struggling with, like, the loss of a relationship, a pill is not going to fix that. If somebody doesn't have a home, a pill is not going to fix that. And so, like, and if somebody wants to end their life, being institutionalized and locked in a room by yourself and shot up with drugs and treated like you're less than human is not going to fix that. Like, and those are the things that I think that we need to really be hitting home these legislators with, and stopping with all of those arguments about getting caught up with the dangerous, not dangerous issue, that it's just not going to fix it, and that it's illegitimate, because we're setting up, I mean, they just got a whole new reach of people because we've been out there screaming, well, we're not dangerous. And so now it's us and everybody who's ever been considered, you know, to have done something illegal that is subject to this. And I think that we just, I don't know, it may not be a popular position, but I feel very passionate about that.
Mm-hmm. You're so right, Lauren. And I didn't mean to bring that up to say that that should be justification, but now what's happening is that people are going beyond that. They're going beyond the fact that they're going way out on the limb. Just a person can have unusual behavior. Just like the story that I brought up, there was in the Washington Post last Sunday, you know, the fact that someone decides to withdraw
the yellow
from,
door, right?
From life. And here's a newspaper has a front page story on the Washington Post. And in fact, they're, I guess, making the story a poster story for commitment, because they said that in another time you would have been able to take these people in, but because of the protection and advocacy that goes on, they can't do that anymore. And I think it's a really sad to say that the Washington Post had that on the front page of their newspaper, promoting taking freedom away from people.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a national newspaper, but you know, so you don't, and my point was that you don't have to do anything. That's why I was asking Anthony what brought to the court. And this is what started happening in Nazi Germany. You know, they, after a while, people will not have to go before a judge or anything. They'll just summarily take people away. And I don't think people understand that the danger is that it will just be okay. People will be kidnapped off the street.
Well, Lauren, isn't it the Murphy bill that's being proposed? Didn't it say that they're looking for people to be AOT'd? Like they're going to actively seek out people?
Yeah. If you look under, if you actually go to read the bill, and because I'm on the road, I don't have my computer in front of me, so I can't read it right to you. But I'll have it ready for when I get back to New York for everyone. But yeah, it's under the AOT grant program, the Involuntary Outpatient Grant Program, which funds them. It provides funding for them to evaluate and finds people to evaluate, to create the treatment plan and to file the petition, and then to oversee that people are getting all the things that are in the treatment plan. So it provides grant money for all of that. So somebody's job is just to, like, go looking for people to qualify for Kendra's Law and getting them written up and file the petition on. You can now get government money to do that. If Mercy passes, if H.R. 3717 passes, and it also does a whole bunch of other things and nationalizes the mandate for involuntary outpatient commitment laws, yeah, it's a real problem, Anthony. Thank you for bringing that up. And, you know, and it's ludicrous because it's funding. It pays for the judges. It pays for all of this. In Murphy, in H.R. 37, that's where, 3717, rather, that's where all of this winds up getting paid for.
But we used to have bounties in the District of Columbia. People would actually get paid for having people. This is a long, long time ago, you know, more than a decade ago. But people used to get paid a certain amount of money if they submitted the person, and as a result of them submitting the person was committed. So this is a bad thing to happen, because I don't want us to go back to where we had where people actually had bounties for bringing people in to be committed. This is what this sounds like.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, and who's going to be turning in, and I, you know, how many of the PR workers are going to get paid for being people who wind up, you know, finding them? Oh, here, look, your peer over there is in need of help. You need to go find them and bring them to us. Fireworks are almost the right kind of thing in the background, like, because we're in a war here. They're killing us. Anthony, if there's anything that we can do, or that you think people can do, or that I can do, please let me and let us know, because I think, you know, that people want to be able to support however they can.
Yeah, I hear you. Thank you.
I'm just surprised they're not more outraged about this, because this is like our night of broken glass, because it is that has so many implications that people just can't fathom, that they think about this as being some kind of medical something, and it's really not. It's like, Lauren, you know, the more that we talk about the Murphy Bill, the more the words of torture and outrage, really, they are deserving of to describe, you know, what they're proposing. Because it is going to have long-range effect. I knew people who were on outpatient commitment before we had, when we had opened in the outpatient commitment. I had met some people who had been on there for decades. And at that time, there was such an abuse of it that people wouldn't even come up. You know, even now, people have to come up every, you know, 6 months for review. But at that time, people would be on outpatient commitment, and they really suffered. They really had, when those supposedly treatments were made, they were court-ordered, even doctors wouldn't go against it. And I can see if in whatever state that Angela Vail lived in, you know, why maybe a nurse practitioner would just continue to write a prescription even though the person's body is being destroyed. And I'm talking about someone who called in a couple of days ago, where actually she had ballooned up to 400 pounds. She was taking the medication was destroying her. She lost her teeth, her mouth, and you know, people don't understand this can happen. That even if even the doctors and the practitioners really should be up in arms about this, because this is going to put them in a bad place as well, because they will be, they will not be able to change orders.
Yeah, I think that this is, you know, people need to be concerned, because this is just one loop forward. You fast forward this 15 years and see where we are and how many people are mandated to this, and 15 years of electronic medical records following people, and then boom, what comes next? And so where they can just extend it, the same way in New York, they just extended it over all women who were pregnant, that there were going to be screenings for maternal depression instead of postpartum depression. Now they're saying that if you have anxiety or panic while you're pregnant, that that's a symptom of postpartum depression, and we need to treat that right away. And so, you know, they're just continually going after more and more groups. And in that maternal screening law is provisions for screening of children to wipe out and eliminate any pre-existing emotional, you know, like for early finding prevention of emotional distress or whatever they call it. And so it's just continuing and getting more and more pervasive. I don't even know what the right word is, but
the next step would be for them to line up to open up all those old new hospitals for people, because it will be to the point for anyone, especially with the expansion of DSM-5, anybody could be subject to this.
Right.
And it could be a long time, even though it's a judicial process, you know, Anthony was saying be patient. But in the meantime, a lot of damage could be done to a person while they're patient.
It really could be. And I've just been given a signal that it's about to get really, really loud here. So I want to, in just a couple of minutes, so I just want to say, Anthony, do you have anything you want to add tonight? And if you would be willing to call back again on the night when we're going to do a full show and concentrated on involuntary outpatient commitment?
Yeah, sure. I'll call back some other time.
That would be great. And do you have any other thoughts that you would be that you would like to discuss at this point?
I'm just hoping, like everybody else listening, that the H.R. 3717 does not get passed, that it doesn't get enacted, because that would be a severe blow to everybody's liberty. And it would definitely be a major setback. I'm just hoping that anybody that's listening, you know, I know that like what the other caller said, that there's a lot of damage being done, even though if you have to be patient. But unfortunately, you know, that's very unfortunate. But you know, just I guess I don't know what else to say, Lauren. You just gotta kind of take it in stride, take it day by day.
Yeah, I really appreciate you calling in and sharing all of this and the struggle, and for people to know that this really creates a struggle for people beyond any of the other issues of just psychiatry, but there's this whole other overlap of how this really takes over your life and all you have to do to fight to even be able to just go to a family occasion without having to, like, wind up having the police come and try to track you down. Like, you know, this is really an overextension of power. And it's not benevolent, and it's not helpful, and it causes more stress and anxiety and issues for people. I mean, it's torture. The whole thing is torture. It's a fraud. Sorry, that one that firework just threw me off a little bit. But it is, and that's the reality of it
It's funny because my court order therapist said that they're doing all this AOT business for me is not an effort to control me, yet it is a measure of controlling somebody. They want to control people. That's why they do it.
Yep.
Right.
Even the people that are for it, if you ask them, and we've asked on this show what the object of the people who advocate for this is, and quite clearly they said that it's all about control.
How could it not be about control? How could this be about anything other than control?
Yes.
Well, like I said, even the people that claim that they're doing it beneficially, they're saying that it's all about control. And also, I think that's going to, you know, I don't want to see it come to pass. It will destroy medicine totally because, you know, the fact that they had a few of these chemicals that came to forth in the last 60 or 70 years that helped some people temporarily for some weeks where they could work on things through talk therapy. And now if they have the carte blanche of force, that's going to interfere with any kind of therapeutic relationship that anyone would have with anybody. Because how can you have trust with someone when all they can do is you could never fire your therapist?
How can you ever tell this person who testifies against you at court in this way? How could you ever tell them anything significant about anything ever? How would they even expect you to? It's the biggest violation on non-physical grounds. Like, I mean, the fact that their whole thing is to have you drugged and injected with drugs and all this other stuff, the physical violations. But there's this idea of, you know, how can they expect you to trust them if you're testifying against them? Why would Anthony?
Yeah, and Lauren, I just want to comment on what you just said about how can you have any sort of trust because if they feel that you're not telling them everything, they'll turn around and this was done to me in court. They just say, well, he's not telling me everything. He has borderline paranoia because he won't tell me everything. It's like you can't win.
It really is such a sham.
Well, it's going to, like I said, that's why I think that psychologists and other people that claim they went into this line of work to help people, they should be up in arms about it as well, because it's going to interfere with the relationships that people have, because they're not going to be able to be honest and truthful. Just as we tell people sometimes now, don't discuss your faith with your therapist because they don't understand that, and they will medicate you till. They will medicate you to death to try to get away, take you away from your faith, and you still may have this manifest the same things that's making them give you all these chemicals until, you know, your body falls apart.
It really is a concern that somebody's spiritual experience can be seen as a psychotic episode and that needs to be medicated away for the rest of their life and justification for the way that for them being able to be treated like this.
With everything, you know, what happened to me was like when this all began, it began for me. I had a very deep, profound, spiritual, mystical experience that I still can't explain. And when I try to tell that to them, when I first told them, they told me it was a psychotic episode, and they told me I'm mentally ill. But I know what I felt. I won't get into the details because I'll be here all night talking about it. But it was a very profound spiritual mystical experience. I felt a connection with everything in the universe, and I tell them this, and they tell you, well, That's a delusion. You're schizoaffective. You're suffering from delusions, and then just pathologize everything. They just write everything down in their notebook, and everything's a mental illness. And once you're labeled mentally ill, there's like almost no escaping it.
It really is such an issue. And Anthony, I understand that you can talk about this for a whole show, and I think other people can too. And people have expressed an interest on having a show just on purely on spiritual experiences that have been then reassigned as psychosis. This seems to me an incredibly common thing that psychiatry does to people, and I think that that would be really important for people to talk about, and that it, you know, that we need to start acknowledging part of when we say, or part of when I say, let me speak for myself, part of when I say that this whole thing is a fraud is exactly because people's inherent original experiences are like spiritual kinds of experiences or something mystical or something deeply emotional or any of that is then cast off as some, you know, quote-unquote psychosis that has no evidence in a biological realm, and yet, you know, and yet we have then to be medicated and forced into it. And it's so infuriating because so you don't have any proof of your spiritual experience, and they don't have any proof of their, you know, supposed brain illness or whatever the hell they call it. And yet they win with no proof. When neither side to be able to show that this is something that actually happens, why is it that their side wins and we consistently lose?
Well, you know, the reason why is because they're scientists. They claim that they're scientists. This is the reason why, for example, John Nash, when he cracked, it was because he was trying to prove the existence of God. Came from West Virginia and he went to Princeton. And this is what happens. People have moral conflict. And I tell people all the time, if you want to get out of it's a conflict even within psychiatry, because they say that people's spiritual belief is important. Inside these institutions or hospitals, they have chaplains. But then they want to tell you that your experience is not valid. So it's a conflict there. They want you to compartmentalize your experience. So I say don't explain to anybody out there, don't talk to your therapist about your relationship with the universe, your relationship with the world, because they don't believe it. They've gone to school, even they've gone to school for 20 years and studied, and they say that there's no evidence that there is, that these things exist.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that it's funny that Yvonne just said that you know, they have chaplains, and they have the chapel in the hospital and all this stuff with the religiosity and spirituality. But when you actually tell them that you actually had an experience and you actually had a spiritual experience of your own, then you're called mentally ill, yet they have chaplains and other spiritual aspects of life in a mental institution. Yet you're labeled as mentally ill if you actually say that you had a spiritual experience. I just think it's kind of, I think it's just kind of weird. I don't think it's very consistent. You know?
No, it's not. It's like Lauren says that there's nothing to show that mental illness is really an illness either. I mean, there's more validity to people's spiritual experiences than there is that there is mental illness. So
right, but why do they not need to prove it? Like, why isn't it that a psychiatrist is experiencing some delusion, that they have the ability to diagnose somebody in some way and that they can tell who's got what? Why isn't that some kind of, you know, problem? Somebody who thinks that they can make such an assessment of another person. You know, the audacity that really requires if you think about it for a little bit.
What they do is this. If you repeat a lie and you keep repeating it often enough, that people think that it's true. That's what it is.
Well,
they repeat the lie, they print the lie, then someone else refers to the lie that was reported by someone else. So then it becomes a fact.
What is it? Never let the truth be interfered. Never let the facts interfere with the truth or something like that.
Right.
Don't let the
facts get in the way. I mean, this is why you had the Washington Post have this headline story. This is why the Wall Street Journal had a story with no mention of who wrote it. And then Tim Murphy waves the story into the congressional record saying, did you not read the Wall Street Journal story? You repeat it a lot. And the thing about it is, unfortunately, we haven't learned to do that enough. The lie gets repeated often enough by enough people of high stature, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, a person who has got a lot of initials behind their name, then people will say they don't question it. It's got to be true. They don't need to see anything else. So Anthony's spiritual experience pales. He doesn't have any degrees. Now, his spiritual experience, if this was 100 years ago, it would be a newspaper.
Even if somebody does have degrees and they say that they have that they're having this kind of experience, they're cast out too. And I'll tell you this: I've talked to psychologists and psychiatrists, both, not many of them, but at least one of each type of these kind of profession, that have individually told me that if they divulge their ideas about spirituality to their colleagues, that they would be seen as mad too. And so they didn't use those words, but that was basically what the gist of the conversation. And, that's part of the problem, is that people who, are experiencing something that is spiritual or something that is not Judeo-Christian, and depending on the religion, sometimes with great discrimination against the person. Even especially like pagan kind of, belief systems, the whole idea of quote unquote magical thinking is part of the diagnostic criteria for schizotypal disorder. And so, if you say that you believe that by thinking things, you can make things happen, or any of that kind of stuff, you're done for. Even somebody believing that God is calling them, that it's their time, that they're or whatever, anything, any of that kind of expression of faith, and certainly anybody since 9/11.
You don't want to say you pray to God and He answers you back, because you really be in trouble.
You could talk to God, but if God talks to you, you better watch out and don't ever say that to a psychiatrist. But I want to just make something else specific that, people who are Muslim also have been in increased scrutiny by psychiatry and have, other kinds of religions instead of Judeo-Christian causes great problems for people. And in America where, you're supposed to have, freedom of religion and freedom of expression and freedom of speech and freedom of press and, happy 4th of July, everybody. These kinds of things are taken away from us and diagnosed as, illnesses. People should be exploding over this. that was well done.
Lauren.
Yeah.
I just wanna reaffirm that when we're talking about the psychiatrist having evidence of there being mental illness at all, right now I'm reading Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whittaker, and I'm halfway through it right now. And it's a great book. I can't put it down. He's going to be the keynote speaker at the Creative Revolutions Conference in Connecticut, which I'll be attending. And I can't wait. I hope I can meet him. But anyway, basically, he talks about the serotonin and the dopamine theory of schizophrenia, and a lot of the theories and a lot of these psychiatrist theories and hypotheses have been shot down already. So their evidence really doesn't hold water.
No, it really doesn't. It doesn't at all. And so I think that this is one of the things that we need to keep focusing on. And, yeah, and if people haven't read Robert Whittaker's book, they should definitely do that. It's just jam-packed with so much information, Anatomy of an Epidemic.
It's available in your library. And for those that are just curious, that is over the weekend, maybe your library's not open, you can go to YouTube and put in Robert Whittaker, and there are any number of film presentations of his will just give you a little taste of the book, and then you can go out and either purchase it over the weekend, or I don't want to sound like I'm trying to give a plug for his book, but it's Whittaker is not a doctor. Whittaker is an investigative reporter, a renowned investigative reporter, and the book is a result of his investigation into the increase, of mental illness. I say this all the time. There's this myth that Tory and others have put out there that somehow there's this a plague upon the land. There's all these people with mental illness that don't know it. We've got to, root it out. This is the heart of the meat of the Murphy Bill. You've got to hunt down these people who don't know that they're sick. They even created an illness to say that, not only are you ill, but you don't know you're ill.
Right. And that they can use that as the legitimacy of their test, and that's their litmus test. That this is, and this is the same as the Fed experiment back in the, I guess it was the 70s or 80s maybe even, where the idea that that they have no idea of what they're doing, and they have no evidence for any of it, and that they can forcibly inject people into that is just so much of a problem.
The book, you thought the book was great, right?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. It's very, very informative.
Mm-hmm. Now, just a suggestion. I wouldn't bring that up at your hearing, because that would be proof that you really are mentally ill.
No, I won't be saying anything about what a book. It's actually funny that you say that, because at my court hearing, when my therapist was testifying, because my therapist testified for me, the prosecution actually had a ploy, actually said, did you recommend this book? And I forgot the name of it. I think it was from Seth Farber.
It was The Spiritual Gift of Madness.
Yeah, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, Rise of Mad Pride. And I had never heard of it before, and I know he did not recommend it to me, and he never heard of it before, and I have no idea where they came out with that. So for me to mention anything about what I'm reading, if I were to testify on the stand, that would definitely be a case for them to use against me as saying that I'm mentally ill. I would not be mentioning what books or what literature I read or who I'm interested in. I'll just have to go along with whatever they say, and hopefully they'll let the AOT go, I hope.
Well, no, you should practice. I'm suggesting, from what I've helped other people, you should practice with someone, because what then they'll say is your effect is flat.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I mean, you have to answer their questions and whatever you have, but you may want to practice with if you have some people in your life that you trust. Practice with another person and another observer, because just like they brought that up, about that book, they probably used that with someone else.
Yeah, they probably used it. Like, when I was speaking with my therapist to the court hearing, he said that they were probably just trying to plant something into my into the judge's mind, thinking that he actually was recommended this and he's actually reading this material and he's actually mentally ill somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing about it with outpatient, the court, is without saying that you're mentally ill, if there's assisted outpatient treatment is not necessary if people are in treatment themselves. And, I mean, whoever you're, I hope that you're not the therapist that is testifying against you. I hope that you don't have to go back to that person.
No, he's not testifying against me. He's testifying for me. I mean, he's on my side.
Oh, okay, that's good.
It's not the court ordered therapist. It's my own therapist that I'm seeing on my own, and he testified in behalf of me.
Great. That's why I say the best thing you can do is to get out of the system and have somebody where they have to answer to you. This whole idea that, you know, I can't see you're going to force somebody for treatment that they have to pay for. Or even if it's not paid for, they're using their insurance to do it. I mean, that's really bad.
Yeah, it's like a racketeering scheme.
Yeah. That's right. It's like it's a racketeering scheme. You got it.
Right.
I mean, this is a billion-dollar industry. They don't want to let you go. I mean, they see dollar signs on your head, boy.
Yeah, they do. me and a lot of other people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's why some people don't believe in people recover, because they just don't want to let that. They just don't want to let that Ulysses S. Grant and Benjamin Franklin's, they just, when people start talking about that, they just see dollars floating out the window.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and I think that's the big points, and I was just told this is it. They're gonna start the show in a minute, and I'm literally in the midst of a fireworks field.
I hope you have a good trip back, Lauren.
Thanks. Yes, tomorrow 9 to 11 will be a full show, and everybody, thank you, Anthony. Keep fighting. Thank you so much for calling in and giving us an update. And perhaps we can, you know, keep on calling in on open lines, but a more formal show specifically on this issue and opening up kind of what happens to people in the court process. And then another show in the future on spirituality and how psychiatry labels that as psychosis, I think, is definitely necessary. So thank you all for tuning in and for listening and for calling and for speaking out. And I'm going to ask you to keep on speaking out until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Good night.